in this year's Reith Lecture Series, delivered by one of the most foremost cultural figures of our day, the eminent pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim. If you wish to hear Act of Worship, it will be on Longwave as usual at 9:45. Well, here on FM, Daniel Barenboim presents the first Reith lecture in an extended hour-long introduction to his series entitled In the Beginning Was Sound. Sue Laurie is in the chair.
Hello and welcome to the Cadogan Hall in West London, where for the first time in the 58-year history of this event, our Reith lecturer is a conductor. He began his musical career as a pianist. This is how he sounded when he was making his debut here in London exactly half a century ago.
He gave a concert at the Royal Festival Hall on Tuesday.
And what did you play then?
Mozart Concerto in A Major.
And then have you done anything else while you've been
yes,
here?
Yes, I gave also a recital at the Wigmore Hall.
Well, there you are. Here's a young man of 13 who's come over, and we thought you'd like to meet him tonight. What are you going to play tonight for us? You're going to play some Chopin. So we'll hear this Chopin now. Here is Daniel Barenboim.
Daniel Barenboim, playing Chopin in London in 1956. He'd given his first concert in Buenos Aires at the age of 7, and at the age of 11, he'd been declared a phenomenon by the legendary conductor Wilhelm Furtwängler. His life has been and continues to be saturated with music. A virtuoso at the piano, he later became a supreme master of the podium. Currently, he's music director of both the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and the Berlin State Opera. In these lectures, he'll be drawing on that lifetime of musical experience to demonstrate that music, as he puts it, is a way to make sense of the world, our politics, our history, our future, and our very essence. Daniel Barenboim doesn't shy from controversy. He's shown himself willing to take courageous public stands. 6 years ago, he founded Against the Odds, an orchestra made up of equal numbers of Arab and Israeli young musicians, the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, not least to demonstrate that it's possible, through music, for people from warring factions to find peaceful coexistence. Today, he'll deliver the first in his series of lectures, which, over the course of the next 5 weeks, will take us from here in London to Chicago, Berlin, Ramallah, and Jerusalem. Ladies and gentlemen, please will you welcome the BBC's Reith Lecturer 2006, Daniel Barenboim.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm perfectly aware of the great honor to be asked to deliver the Reith Lectures. It is with some slight trepidation that I do that, because I firmly believe that it is really impossible to really deeply speak about music. All we can do then is speak about our own reaction to the music. So maybe the honor is dubious, or maybe the BBC thought it would be very short. In any case, the impossible has always attracted me more than the difficult. The impossible, if there is some sense behind it, has not only a feeling of adventure, but a feeling of activity, which I do admit I enjoy very much. I will therefore attempt the impossible and maybe try and draw some connection between the inexpressible content of music and maybe the inexpressible content of life. In Chicago, I will try to discover why it is that we are neglecting our ears so much and why we have become such a visual society and why it is that the eye seems to have so much more power than the ear. In Berlin, I will try, always with connection to music, obviously, to explain why I think that it is so difficult in today's world to grow up when we don't really give our children real education, but at best information, and that this is why words have lost their meaning and words that are full of content have become pejorative. This leads us very often to create or develop a society in which we don't dare make judgments and make a point of view, have a point of view. Contradiction in terms when I've just said that the ear is more important than the eye, and here am I speaking about a point of view. But the mental point of view is no different from the point of view of the film director. In Ramallah, I will speak about the ability of music to integrate and how it is that a musician is, by the sheer nature of his profession in many ways, an integrating figure. If a musician is unable to integrate rhythm, melody, harmony, volume, speed, he cannot make music. And to end in Jerusalem, I will try to explain what to me is a very major difference between power and strength, something which I learned very precisely from music, that if you attack a chord with more power than you are going to sustain it, it has no strength. We are at the first, if you want, connection between the inexpressible content of music and in many ways the inexpressible content of life. There have been many definitions of music which, to my mind, have only described a subjective reaction to it. The only really precise one, to me, is the one by Ferruccio Busoni, the great Italian pianist and composer, who said that music is sonorous air. It says everything and it says nothing. Of course, appropriate moment to quote Nietzsche, who said that life without music would be a mistake. And now we come to the first question, why? Why is music so important? Why is music something more than something very agreeable or exciting to listen to? Something that through its sheer power and eloquence gives us formidable weapons to forget our existence and the chores of daily life. My contention is that this is of course possible and is practiced by millions of people who like to come home after a long day at the office, put their feet up, if possible, have the luxury of somebody giving them a drink while they do that, and put on a record and forget all the problems of the day. But my contention is that music has another weapon that it delivers to us, if we want to take it, and that is one through which we can learn a lot about ourselves, about our society, about the human being, about politics, about society, about anything that you choose to do. I can only speak from that point of view in a very personal way, because I learn more than about how to make a living out of music. And so I propose to you, before we embark on this journey, that we look at the moment at this physical phenomenon that is the only way through which music expresses itself, and that is sound. Now, when people speak about sound, they speak very often in terms of colors. This is a bright sound. This is a dark sound. This is very subjective. What is dark for one is light for the other, and vice versa. But there are some elements of sound which are not subjective, and I think that, if you'll allow me to, I would like to spend a few minutes on that. If sound is a physical phenomenon, which it obviously is, then one should be able to observe it as such in a very discerning and in a very rational way. The first thing we notice about sound, of course, is that it doesn't live in this world. Whatever concert took place in this hall earlier today or yesterday, the sounds have evaporated. They are ephemeral. So, although sound is a very physical phenomenon, it has some inexplicable metaphysical hidden power. The physical aspect that we notice first is that sound does not exist by itself, but has a permanent, constant, and unavoidable relation with silence. And therefore, the music does not start from the first note and goes on to the second note, etc., etc. But the first note already determines the music itself, because it comes out of the silence that precedes it. Added to that, some instrument, percussion instruments primarily, and the piano is one of them, have a real life duration. In other words, and is over. Other instruments, like the violin, or the oboe, or a brass instrument, non-percussive instruments, one can, and one does, manage to sustain them longer than the real-life duration of a sound as compared to a percussion instrument. And therefore, the beginning, the first sound, is already in relation to the silence that precedes it. You must forget for a moment, please, that there are such things as technologically developed devices which permit to maintain the sound, artificially so. And this is no ungratefulness to the radio, to the recordings, to the CDs and all other means that we have to preserve the unpreservable. But the fact remains that when you, even in the old days, when you had a gramophone recording and you put the needle on the record, the sound was suddenly there. And then there was a sound. Now we go directly into the sound, but it gives us no idea whatsoever about how this is produced. And this is why many young conductors today think they can learn a score from listening to records. Fantastic lifting of the arms, bring them down, and the perfect C major chord with blazing trumpets and inaudible strings is heard. But let's look at the different possibilities, therefore, of the first note. If we achieve a total silence and we start a piece of music that becomes rather than is there, it's not about being but about becoming, it's obviously a different case from starting something loud and blatantly. The prelude to Tristan and Isolde is an obvious case. In other words, the music is not from the A to the F, but from the silence to the A, first of all. And this is, of course, the main difficulty. There are many ways. It doesn't have to be slow music. There's also Beethoven's Sonata, Opus 109. But suddenly, the pianist has to create the feeling that the music has already been here, it's already going. And now, much as you step on a train that is already in motion, you join it. And you cannot start with an accent of the first note, because by definition, the first note will be an accent because it interrupts the silence. The next observation about sound is if it has a relation with silence, what kind of relation is it? Does it dominate silence? Can silence stop the sound when it wants? Can the sound go over the silences? Is that all a realistic possibility? And I think if we observe that clearly, we notice that sound reacts to silence much like the law of gravity tells us that if you lift an object from the ground, you have to use a certain amount of energy to keep it at the height to which you have brought it up to. You have to provide additional energy, otherwise the object will fall back to the law of gravitation on the ground. But this is exactly what sound does with silence. I play again the same note, I play it, I give a certain amount of energy, and if I do nothing more to it, it will die. This is the length of the duration of the life of this C-sharp produced by my finger on this piano. Now, there may be other fingers that can do it longer or shorter, and other pianos that will do that, but basically, this is it. And there we are at the first clear expression of content in music. The contact with silence, with gravitation. What did I say just now? The note dies. And this is the beginning of the tragic element in music. For me, you understand that all of what I'm telling you now is what I have learned to feel and hope to have learned through all these years of making music. I'm in no way pretending to give you a fundamentalist theory that provides all the answers, even for those things where there are no questions about. But for me, this relation between sound and silence is imperative to understand, because it does produce the first tragic element of expression in music. I pondered for a very long time on this subject, and I will not bore you with all the details, but it is obvious that if a sound has a beginning, we have already seen it also has a duration, and it has an end, whether it dies or whether the next note comes. And then you get one more other means of expression, of content, if you want, of music, and that is that the notes in music cannot be allowed to develop their natural egos so that they hide the preceding one. But the expression in music comes from the linkage, what we call in Italian legato. Okay, five notes that are bound, each note fights against the power of silence that wants to make it die, and is therefore in relation to the preceding note and to the note that comes after that. So when you play five notes, if each note had a big ego, it would want to be louder than the note before. And therefore, I learned from that very simple fact that no matter how great an individual you are, music teaches you that the creativity only works in groups, and the expression of the group is very often larger than the sum of the parts. And you can draw whatever conclusions you want from this, but I think that this is a not unimportant factor. And in, maybe in a strange way, I found some answers to all this, not in music, but in philosophy, especially from reading regularly and for many years the Ethics of Spinoza. Spinoza was a religious scholar, a political architect, a philosopher who aspired to geometric demonstration of the universe and the human being in it, and he was a biological thinker who advanced the science of emotions. And there lies, of course, one of the great difficulties of making music, the science of emotions. How do you play with passion and with discipline? Having realized all of this, I saw that there was a need for knowledge, and this much abused word, "he is so musical," was absolutely senseless, because talent is certainly not enough. If music is sound with thought, then talent is a very poor weapon to have at one's disposal. All this has brought me to the conclusion that I'm very unhappy, and for a long time, about the place of music in society. This is the path that I will try to explore further in the next lectures. Music can, and from my individual point of view, should become something that is used not only to escape from the world, but rather to understand it. Thank you very much.
Daniel Barenboim, thank you very much indeed. Now it's question time, and here in the Cadogan Hall we have an 800 or so strong audience made up of artists, scientists, politicians and others. Some of them music lovers, some of them maybe not, who knows. Do they accept what you're saying, that music is a metaphor for life, that through music we can arrive at a better understanding of the human condition? Well, let's have some questions from them to test you on that. So, can I have some questions, please? Gentleman here?
Maestro Barenboim, David Miller. I had the pleasure of interviewing you in Berlin when you started with the East-West Divan Orchestra. Music helps us to understand and interpret the world, but of course I think you see music as a way of changing the world, do you not? And also you've spent a lot of time, you probably don't have, founding an orchestra of young Israelis and young Arabs as a way of showing that people can not only coexist together in a rather grudging way, they can actually make music, they can do something enthusiastically together. So music, you obviously see as something that can bring about political change. How is that going, and how do you think we can measure the success or otherwise of this really rather extraordinary venture that you've embarked upon?
Well, I hope we have time at least until tomorrow morning, because you have raised at least 10 questions in that one seemingly innocent question. First of all, I thank you for your compliments, and it's very flattering, but I'm afraid I have to disappoint you that this project is not a project for peace. The West Eastern Divan answers one very important question, and that is that there is a tremendous amount of ignorance on both sides, and that there is very little that can be done to integrate the people from the different countries, because the initial conditions for dialogue is not there, namely equality. The West Eastern Divan is a forum which came out of the musical idea, because what do we do when we make music? We express ourselves, but we also listen. If we don't listen to the other voices, whether they are subversive, as sometimes in Bach fugues, when the subject comes a second time and the counterpoint has a completely different character. It's subversive. Unless we do that, we cannot make music. And therefore, in our utopian republic, as I like to think of it, of the West Eastern Divan, we have learned and we give everybody the opportunity to express himself, herself, to the enemy, and also to hear the version of the enemy, to listen and to hear it, and therefore not necessarily to agree with it, but to understand the other narrative. And therefore, there is automatically a common terrain on the music, because in front of the Beethoven symphony, they are all equals. In real life, they are not. The work with the West Eastern Divan is not to give each other comfort, but to understand how music is structured and how music can only exist when all the different elements, whether they are rhythm, melody, harmony, let's stop at those three, are connected, and nothing in music is independent.
But you want them to take the metaphor from that for life, is that what you're saying?
Yes, so that they have to listen to the other. This has nothing to do with comfort, it's to try to understand the other.
Okay, I'm going to take a question here.
Steve Motland, I'm a composer. I wondered what you thought the role of living composers was in terms of what you're suggesting. What can composers contribute?
Well, composers can contribute by writing good music. Obviously. I mean, I make no distinction. I'm not talking about the music of the 18th century. You know, I'm playing tomorrow the second book of the Well-Tempered Clavier in London. Let me tell you something. I played it yesterday evening in Paris, and I had the feeling when I finished it that all music that was written since then is actually unnecessary. No, I'm not being funny, because everything is already there in embryo. When you think that you write with the same 12 notes, that every piece of music that was written before Bach already, including the Beatles, including Schoenberg, Puccini, and all other unlikely bedmates, all this was written with the same 12 notes. And therefore, the question, the power of music, has nothing to do with being contemporary or not being contemporary. The task of the composer today is made so much more difficult than it was before, because very few people practice music. And they think that if they love music and they go home and play a record, that this is music appreciation. But I maintain that if I sat down, as I will, and play the first three bars of Schoenberg Opus 11, nobody here will have the feeling, oh, this is modern music, you know, and Schoenberg is already 100 years ago. But when you put them in the concert, these pieces, people have difficulty going to it. This is the beginning of Schoenberg Opus 11. Don't tell me that this is purely an intellectual exercise. The relation between the harmonies, I didn't get to that. I will do that in the next lecture in Berlin, probably.
Okay, I'm going to take a question here.
Julian Lloyd-Webber, cellist. Maestro, from all the recent work you've been doing, it seems obvious that you believe, as I do, that music is for all people, whatever their race, religion, or colour. Do you think there's a danger of some educationalists assuming that because children are from certain ethnic backgrounds, and I'm thinking particularly here of our inner city schools, that somehow classical music is not for these children?
I think nothing could be further away from the truth. And in fact, we have seen that we have started a music education program in Ramallah, which has now spread to other cities in the West Bank, in a society which is not known for its practice of classical music. And yet, in a very short time, The music education program has given them a wonderful ability to express themselves and has given them a dignity which they were unable to get only through words. When one is able to share a passion with somebody else, a bond is created which is very, very strong.
There's a very famous voice sitting just in front of you, sir. Willard White, I see there.
Willard, would you like to put a point?
Well, I'm a singer myself, and my life has been transformed by music, and I recognize the importance, the significance of music in lives. But sometimes I think that, you know, people have asked me, why is it that more black people aren't in classical performances, for example? And I think, what right have we to push music on them? There is this free will that we have. Of course, music education should be, could be enhanced, but it's like, you know, you talk about the subversive quality of music. There's a subversion in the reluctance maybe of some people to join in music making.
Yes, but I think, Willard, first of all, I'm very glad that you are here, and I know you're speaking the truth, because I had the pleasure to make music with you, so I know how much it means to you too. Having said that, I don't think that this has to do with free will. It has to do with the necessity to accept that music is an essential part of education, or not. If it is that, and you get the education, then out of your free will, you choose not to exercise it. But ignorance has not yet, for me, acquired the category of free will decision. First, you have to know about it.
Thank you very much, Willard White, for that. I'm going to take a question up there.
Hi, my name's Alinka Greasley, and I'm researching everyday uses of music with Alex Lamont and John Sloboda at Keele University. My question relates to something you said sort of earlier on in your lecture. My research shows that people talk about very ordinary, everyday music listening experiences as having great personal significance for them. For example, one woman described an epiphany experience while sitting in her lounge listening to a pop group, Hanson. And my question to you is, how far down do you feel musical value extends?
I think this is not only related to music, it's related to knowledge. Some people believe that if they have knowledge about things, they will lose the freshness of the approach to it. I believe that if you have knowledge about something, you have a better chance to not only to understand it, but to live it, and therefore to enjoy it. It is obvious that if you listen to a pop group, or even let's take one stage in between, if you listen to Strauss waltz on the 1st of January, beautifully played, you do need less, shall we say, knowledge, yes, knowledge of what is this power of music, what comes out of music in the sense of structuring emotions and filling forms with emotion and doing all those things, than if you are listening to the suite Opus 23 of Schoenberg. You obviously need more knowledge.
Do you accept then, Daniel Barenboim, that pop music can have that same transcendental power that you were describing that Western classical music has?
If you feel it, how wonderful for you.
There must be some jazz musicians here. Any jazz lovers? What about your style of music? Jazz lover here.
I'm Julian Joseph, jazz musician. And my question is that I agree with you about learning about life from music and the way the relationships between harmony and unity and working with different musicians and being open and all of those aspects. And my question to you is just where do you see improvisation in that whole area of learning from
improvisation
music?
Improvisation is the highest form of art for me, because when you see a score for the first time and you don't know it, and therefore You don't understand it. You have only a gut reaction to it. The first reaction is gut. Instinct. No matter how talented you are, the most talented person in the world will not at first sight be able to analyze. So, this is your first reaction. Then, we take the music and we analyze it and we work it and we think about it and we turn it upside down and everything. And we acquire a lot more knowledge than we had at the first encounter. And at that stage of the proceedings, we have lost a lot of the freshness. We have forgotten the gut completely, and we are only thinking, and here the subject comes twice as fast, and this is twice as slow, and the modulation comes here, etc., 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 etc. But if we play like this, we are not doing any art. We only get to this possible stage of making music. Possible. The moment we have digested all that, and we achieve a kind of conscious naivety, which allows us to improvise it, which allows us to play it at that moment as if it is on the spur of the moment. And very often, when you have worked things in depth and you then play it at the spur of the moment, something tells you and makes you go in a direction that you didn't go in the 200 times that you played it at home and you worked at it. But it would not have been possible without the 200 times. And this is why improvisation, that means the state of just sitting at the piano and suddenly, in a completely unpremeditated way, your fingers, your heart, your brain, your gut, everything pushes you in a direction that you improvise and you literally then create music. It's a very blessed state in the life of a human being.
I'm going to take a few different points from the audience and ask you, Daniel, for a compendium answer. Let's take the lady there, yes.
My name's Leslie Garrett. I'm a singer. When I was a child...
I know you.
Hello, Daniel. When I was a child, I understood immediately that through music and through singing could I express how I felt, and only through music and through singing. My concern is, and my question to you is, that society seems now to be much more concerned with the visual. My children are now constantly bombarded with imagery from television, from DVD, from computers, from electric games and so forth. How do we teach our children to listen in the way that it seemed to be effortless for me? And then if there isn't this possibility for our children to listen and to understand this connection, which I believe is visceral and common to all of us, between what we hear and these innermost feelings and the expression of these feelings, how then are we going to look after our children's emotions when older?
Yeah, I think, Leslie, that the situation is even worse than you describe it, because not only has the eye taken over, but we have anesthetized the ears through all the music that we hear all the time.
Yes.
You know, I have been for the last, I don't know how many years, in Chicago. And I stay in the hotel in Chicago. And every day I go on the lift and I hear bits of the Brahms violin concerto or the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante. And I not only I hate it, but I know that every one of the people that goes in that lift and comes in the evening to the concert, and God forbid we should be playing the Brahms violin concerto, he will not hear it because he will not listen. And in English you have this wonderful difference between listening and hearing, and that you can hear without listening and you can listen and not hear. Not every language has that. And I think that we have done everything to anesthetize the ear, and this is why the eye has so much importance. And in fact, the ear, I don't want to talk too much about that because it's supposed, I made up my mind to talk about it in another lecture. But maybe you'd like to come with us to Chicago. I'll talk about that.
Let me get you off.
I'll talk about that in Chicago. But it is really true. And the eye is an imperative necessity. When a child learns to cross the street, for the first time the parents say, look to the right, excuse me, in England, look to the left, look to the right, to make sure that a car doesn't come. In other words, in order to survive, you need your eyes.
Perhaps you might agree that opera is perhaps the ultimate art form, as it's the perfect...
Nonsense. In opera, people don't look and don't listen. They only watch the conductor. He's sitting right there. They only watch the conductor.
Let me get us off this hook, because somewhere in this hall we have a neuroscientist, I think, who's tested what it does to the brain. There he is. Give us your name and tell us what you've done. And does music going into the brain harm it or excite it?
Hi, I'm Professor Lawrence Parsons, and I'm a brain scientist. And what we do is we put musicians in brain scanners and monitor the blood flow in the brain while they perform on an electric piano, for example, or singers in other cases, but on an electric piano. And two of the things we notice are that the brain areas that would normally be excited and represent the emotional responses to music are not active for the musician who's performing, relative to playing scales, for example. And we also notice that large other regions of the brain are also deactivated. They're not engaged. And those are regions that allow you to plan the future, to think about what's going on in the environment for salient events. So my two findings about brains of musicians who are performing suggests that the performance of music allows us to get to some sort of inner peaceful place in which our emotional worries and our attention to the world are detached. Now, you refer to this, as many of us do, as heart and brain, but as a brain scientist, it all happens in the brain.
You didn't say what sort of music you were playing to
this
brain.
This is Bach.
Bach.
So okay. One thing I might ask you is whether your own intuitions, as you play the well-tempered clavier, for example, fit this scientific view of what's happening in the brain of a musician like yourself.
You know, I won't be able to play tomorrow. No, I know what you are talking about. You know, when you play music, you get this peaceful quality, I believe, also because you are in control of something, or at least you are attempting to control something that you cannot do in the real world. You can control life and death of a sound. And if you imbue every note with a human quality, when that note dies, it is exactly that. It is a feeling of death. And therefore, through that experience, you transcend any emotion that you can have in daily life. And in a way, you control time. I mean, we all know that when we are bored, 2 minutes seem like 2 hours, and when we're interested, 2 hours are 2 seconds. But when you do that, and I'm especially conscious of that now because I've been playing both books of the Well-Tempered Clavier on several occasions in the last few weeks in Europe, you have the feeling of a journey through history. In other words, a journey that is much longer than the life of a human being. When I finish playing one of the books of the Well-Tempered Clavier, I have the feeling that this is actually much longer than my real life.
I think what you say fits with what the subjects in my experiments told me.
The artist and the scientist are at one. I'm going to leave you there at one and take a question over here. Thank you.
Hello, my name is James McMillan. I'm another composer. Recently, the English musicologist Julian Johnson produced a fascinating book called Who Needs Classical Music? He implies that serious music has suffered in the face of the apparent triumph of the visual and the verbal, but also of what he would say is the banal and even the populist. And therefore, my question is this: what is it about serious music that baffles and indeed, in some cases, offends the advocates of an ever-increasingly ubiquitous, narrow, some might say debased, popular culture? Is it its very ability to rise from the mundane? Is it the suggestion that there may be such a thing as a secret inner life which cannot be reduced to a rigorously enforced commonality, that there may be no such thing, indeed, as a closed universe?
Wow. Well, I think I might be the wrong person for you to talk to, because I don't believe in all these things. I believe that things, creations, objects are neither moral nor immoral. It's when the human being makes use of it that he, this is the free will, he decides whether it is moral or whether it is immoral. What is a knife? Is that an instrument with which you can murder someone, therefore an instrument of violence? Or is it something with which you cut the bread and feed your neighbor? The knife in itself is perfectly innocent. The music is innocent. It's what the human being makes of it. Only the human being is not courageous by nature, and the human being always likes to blame something else, somebody else or something else. And therefore he says, classical music is elitist, classical music is transcendent. I'm sorry, classical music is none of that. Classical music is nothing until it comes into contact with the human being. I can plead exactly the opposite of that. I can tell you that making music and playing in an orchestra is the best way to understand democracy. Elitist? What do you mean elitist? The oboe plays the most wonderful tune in a slow movement of a Brahms symphony, and the whole orchestra, all 90 or 95 of them, and the conductor with the big ego is following him. Everybody's following him. Everybody supporting him. Adjusting everything for him to be able to express this thing. He's the king of the world. And that lasts for 8 bars. Now, I have to finish that. And then, on the 9th bar, he goes back in the society, in the collective. And he has to do what 95 people have been doing for him for 85 bars. He has to do maybe for the double basses or for the clarinet or whatever the case may be. I'm sorry, music is not democratic. Music is not elitist. Music is not transcendental. It's what the human being does with it that it becomes moral, immoral, amoral, transcendental, or sheer nonsense.
If I can, right. Lady up a quick point, if you will.
It's Dr. Alison Leving. I'm a music therapist. And I work with people who have no technical skill in music, have no, perhaps, ability to actually appreciate music in the traditional sense of the word. But we are all musical beings. There's something musical about us all. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that really early state of how we are in music, that our musical beings are born very early in the broadest sense of the word.
Yeah. You know, I was a child prodigy, so to speak. I mean, there is no such a thing as a child prodigy. Somebody asked me not long ago, since you became an adult, have you met a child prodigy? I said, no, never, but many parents, you know. But, I mean, the reason I'm telling you this is because I think that children find it, and I would find it much more fun if I were able to be 3 years old again, to learn about discipline from rhythm than from my mother telling me, and don't do that, and now is the time to eat, and you eat and don't do that, and you will learn one day this kind of discipline. Well, if you can really learn that in the kindergarten through rhythms, and you know that you cannot mess around with them, that there is a certain order to it, then I think you learn about life through the music at a very early age. And then you grow a little bit older, and you come into the puberty, and you have your first associations with sensuality and passion and all that. And if you remember your experience with the music at 3 years old, and you have a connection with music, you know that in order to make music, you have to somehow combine passion and discipline. But I'm sorry, I don't know about you, but this has always been a subject that I've had to battle with all my life. And I think every human being does that.
But if you want, as you said, us to put music give it a greater precedence in our lives, then we have to make music more and not just receive.
Of course, we have to make music, and we have to teach our children from the beginning the connection between music and real life. I have learned a lot of things. I said it earlier, only half in jest, that I learned more from music about living than, you know, about making a living in music. I really did. I learned many things. I remember, in fact, if you want, I can demonstrate it. It's rather silly, but I will do that. I remember my great and admired friend Edward Said and I having very passionate discussions at the time of the beginning of the Oslo process. And he being, from the very first moment, absolutely against it. And I still hoping that somehow some things will happen. And then as time went by, I said to him, and we had really very, I wouldn't say disagreeable, but very hefty arguments about that. Until one day, I said to him, I said, you know, Edward, I said, it doesn't really matter if Oslo is right or wrong. It will never work, because the relation between content and time is erroneous. I said, this I've learned from music. And he looked at me and said, what are you talking about? And I said to him, the preparation for the beginning of the Oslo discussions was practically non-existent, much too quick. And the process itself, once the discussion started, was very slow, and then it was interrupted. And then they said they would meet next Tuesday, and then it was cancelled on Monday, and then they met again a month later, and everything. It had no chance. And I sat down at the piano, and I showed to him what I meant, which I will do for you now. I'm sure many of you know the Pathetic Sonata of Beethoven, which has a very majestic, slow introduction. Etc. And this introduction goes on for whatever number of bars it does, and then there is the main movement, allegro. Etc. Okay. And I said to him, Oslo, the equivalent of Oslo would be if I would play the introduction very fast and without any preparation of anything. In other words, you would not understand anything what I'm doing. And then I would get to the main allegro and I would play. And our discussion stopped from that moment on about Oslo, because we both agreed it wouldn't work for different reasons. Okay. But it's true. In other words, there's a permanent relation between content and time.
Question here, then we must wrap up.
Sue Blackmore, I'm a psychologist from Bristol. Sue Lawley ought to ask this, really, not me, but suppose you only had 1 minute left to live. What would you play, and would you play it for us now?
Would I play what?
If you have 1 minute left to live, and will you play it for us now?
You only want me to have 1 minute left?
1 minute.
I have to tell you before we began that Daniel Barenboim predicted that someone would ask him to play, yeah. So...
This is why I refuse to sit at the piano to answer the questions. No, I don't really feel... But I never think in those terms. The most wonderful thing
the most wonderful thing about playing music, two most wonderful things about playing music, is that no matter how much you learn and how much you open your brain and get additional knowledge with understanding, since you deal with sound, the next morning you start from scratch. And you get a wonderful combination of more knowledge and nothing materially there to show for it. Only the ability to find the courage in yourself to start again from scratch with more knowledge than the day before. I think this is a very positive thing, and that people played music. That's why one of the reasons why I think people would be happier playing music. And I don't want to think about the last minute of my life to play, because I am rather happy, I would say almost proud of the fact that I attempt, don't achieve, attempt to play every concert as if it was both the first and the last.
That's it. In Chicago, where for the past 17 years, Daniel Barenboim has been music director of the city's great symphony orchestra, as he closes the piano lid behind me. But he's unlikely to be constrained by the familiarity of his surroundings. On the contrary, he's going to be railing against the nation that he argues has relegated music to oral, as in A-U-R-A-L, wallpaper. Muzak is more dangerous to health than smoking, says the maestro. There'll be more of that. That's Daniel Barenboim, the Reith lecturer, next week, same time, different place. For now, Mr. Barenboim, thank you very much indeed.
Sue Lawley introduced the Reith Lectures, delivered by Daniel Barenboim. The producer was Tony Phillips and the editor, Gwyneth Williams. On the BBC Radio 4 website, there's a transcript of that lecture. It's also available via the Listen Again feature, and you'll be able to get each week's lecture as a podcast. In 1905, the New Zealand All Blacks, who were considered one of the best rugby sides in the world at the time, played Wales at Cardiff Arms Park.